If you're innovating, creating, or making a difference,
this show is for you. Welcome to Over Coffee. I'm Dot Cannon. Here on Over Coffee, we talk with artists and innovators about the process of changing the world in terms of what they do.
I know I wanted to bring a goat into the Apple store, and I asked Apple people, could you bring a goat? And they said, I don't see why not.
Comedian and filmmaker Mark Malkoff comes up with and videotapes wildly creative, off-the-wall stunts that have a tendency to challenge our preconceptions of what is and isn't possible. Mark's past adventures have included living in an IKEA store for a week and contacting celebrities he doesn't know to ask to sleep over at their homes. Mark talked about his background, what's involved in creating some of his videos, and his current projects. Mark, what do you remember very best from your growing up years in Hershey, Pennsylvania?
Oh my goodness, the town smells like chocolate when it's windy or rainy. So I'd be taking a math test at Hershey Middle School, and it would smell like chocolate, which I found weird, but even more strange. Nobody would ever talk about the fact that it smelled like chocolate and that the streetlights were in the shape of Hershey Kisses. So that was my childhood, and no one acknowledged it until I left, and then it was like, what was that? That was different.
What would you say the effects of growing up in a town that smelled like chocolate had on your creativity?
Oh, my goodness, that is a good question. Well, in terms of creativity, you know, there wasn't a lot to do most of the time, but we would get these concerts that would come in. U2 was in town for a whole week one time rehearsing, so we would get these pockets of creative people that would come in, and that always just really, you know, did something to me and just connected me to the arts and made me realize that this is something I wanted to do in my life. And I started taking trips to New York when I was a teenager and would go to Letterman and would camp out for Saturday Night Live. And it was one of those things to go from Hershey to New York City. It was going from Earth to the moon. It was just very night and day. And there was no internet back then to kind of, like, I don't know, I feel like everything is so much closer with the internet. So it was just a very powerful thing to go from Hershey to New York and then, you know, back.
Major creative culture shock here. When did you first realize that your specific talents were comedy, writing, performance like you do?
I don't know when I realized it, but I knew from the time I was about 4 or 5, it's what I wanted to do. I would always do sketches and stuff. Even from the time I was kindergarten, I would hang shower curtains in my basement and put on shows. There was a library book about what goes on in a television studio, and I would check that out every single week. The librarian, Mrs. Perkowitz, would make fun of me. I knew I wanted to work in TV. I knew I wanted to do this. And I don't think it probably was until high school that I realized I could probably make a living doing this. And I knew it would take a while to be able to make a living. I just didn't know how long. It took forever.
When did you first really realize, yes, this could work for me, I could make a living doing this?
Well, I started writing letters to the cast of Saturday Night Live when I was a teenager without any expectations. I think I was reading TV Guide, and it just listed the address for 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York, where I knew they did the show, and they started writing me back. I got to talk to some of them on the phone, and to be a teenager and to talk to those people on the phone, again, no internet, no way to reveal how the tricks are done. I mean, now you can see how Saturday Night Live is done. They put, like, bonus features backstage. There was nothing like that. So to be able to talk to these people, and then subsequently I got to go up to the show and meet everybody to be a teenager in the early 90s, it did something to me, and it just really showed if they can do this and they're taking the time to talk to me, I think I can make this happen.
That must have been incredible. What do you remember very best from one of those conversations with one of the SNL cast members?
Oh, my gosh. I got a call on my answer machine from Adam Sandler. It was the spring of 92, and I couldn't believe it. My mom is so casual about this thing. She said, somebody from Saturday Night Live called you. I still have the answering machine message. And then I got a call a couple days later. My brother said, Mark, somebody on the phone for you. And I said, hello? This Marky Mark Malkoff? Yes. You know who this is? No. It's Adam Sandler. And it was the second season on SNL. Wasn't the superstar, the $20 million man that he is now, but still I was really, really liked his work. It was different than what anyone else was doing at the show. And we talked for 5 minutes, and it was the first time I ever talked to anybody famous on the phone. It just blew my mind. And then October 27th, 92, a bunch of months later, I met him in the 30 Rock lobby, and he gave me his phone number, and it was just Yeah, it's very impactful as a kid. It made me realize I need to move to New York when I graduate college, and this is really what I want to do, and it's a reachable goal.
What an amazing guy he sounds like. That's incredible. Take me forward in time, would you, to when you did move to New York. What was that like the first months after you graduated?
It was really scary because all my friends, for the most part, went to places like Penn State where they knew tons of people, and I went to NYU, which I knew my grades weren't good enough to get in, but I'm really good at talking my way into things. So I had a good essay, I had a good audition, and a good interview, and they put me on academic probation, but they accepted me. So I moved here. I didn't know anyone. It was still scary in Times Square. It was not New York City today. It was just on the cusp of changing. So it was really lonely. I mean, the only place I really felt comfortable was up around, you know, NBC, and I would go up to the Rainbow Room because I made friends and stuff on the top of Rockefeller Center and hang out. But besides that, it probably took me a year or so just to get kind of comfortable down in the Village. And it was definitely fish out of water. And I got a job early on, I think when I was around 18, at the Boston Comedy Club, which was down on 3rd between Thompson and Sullivan. And that was very eye-opening because you had all these famous people now that are famous that were not famous that were just about to break, like Dave Chappelle and Dane Cook, Daryl Hammond right before he got Saturday Night Live, and Ray Romano was doing stuff at the Comedy Cellar. So I got to know all these people before they became famous, and that was just a good learning process to be around all these people that had paid their dues literally for years that were just about to break. So that was a good education for me to be that young and to be around that.
In that learning process, what was the best lesson you received? Well, one of the best lessons you received.
I think the lessons were that it definitely takes everybody a while. Even Dave Chappelle, who I think moved here when he was a teenager, everyone told me he was going to be this international superstar, and it still took him a while for that to happen. I think everyone thought that was going to happen a lot sooner than it did. And people like Ray Romano, I remember talking to him about he really just needed money. He had newborn twins, and it was really one of these things where he would do all these showcases for, like, the MTV people, and they all wanted hip and edgy, and Ray was doing stuff about his family. And it took Dave Letterman. He went on Letterman, and that was, Letterman said, let's give him his own sitcom, and they got his show on CBS, and he became the highest paid sitcom actor, I think, in the history of the business at the time. And that was just a guy who was just really struggling, and it just showed me that you have to put the work in and you just have to keep at it, and just it does not happen overnight.
And fast forward to today, when you have put the work in and now you have videos all over the place and you watch 252 Netflix, went to 171 Starbucks, etc. When did you first start to do the stunts that you do today?
I started doing the comedy videos right before YouTube, and it was strange. I had no expectations. I was doing the videos, showing them to friends in a theater down on the Lower East Side. I just had my own show where I would show videos. And then within 9 months, I started making international news about these videos, and it was completely accidental. I had no idea that people would flock to them. And then I just started doing these challenge videos just to amuse myself, and I started getting booked on the Today Show, and Jay Leno featured my Starbucks project, and it just took off. It still took me a little bit of time to figure out how to monetize and make a career out of it, which I do full time, but it was really exciting. I mean, people still call online video the wild, wild west, but back then it definitely was. It was YouTube, and online was just very experimental. So I started doing these challenges where I wanted to see if I could go to every single Starbucks store in Manhattan, all 171 in less than 24 hours, make a purchase and consume something. That video was my national television debut on the Today Show, and I was on CNN and Fox News, and Leno was showing stuff. And then soon after, I did a video series called Mark Lives in IKEA, where I lived and slept in IKEA for a week. And that was, I mean, I had friends in countries around the world that were reading about it that had no idea I was going to be doing this. So those were the two things that really kind of put me on the map, and I still hear about them to this day, and that was 5 years ago.
That was incredible, watching the video for Starbucks.
I don't remember a lot of it. It was a hot July day. It took me 23 hours, and I was up for 27 hours on 2 hours of sleep. So, yeah, I was a little disoriented for most of that day.
How sick were you afterwards drinking all that coffee?
I was sick for 3 days in massive, massive pain. It was one of those things at the time I did not drink coffee. So now I do. I drink black coffee one cup a day, and that stemmed out of from doing another project. But drinking all that coffee, hot July day on a bicycle, yeah, it was just a disaster in terms of me being able to function. After 12 hours, my body started to shut down. I couldn't walk in a straight line, and then I had to ditch my bicycle. My friend Jill came in with a car, and they just kind of threw me in to the remaining locations, but we pulled it off. I mean, it was lots of prayer, lots of preparation. I mean, it took me over a month to prepare for that video, and we tried it once with a car, and it didn't work. I mean, one of the lessons I really learned from these videos is preparing as much as you can, and, you know, anything is possible, trying to pull off the impossible. I have emails from people telling me that this would never happen, and just setting out to see what I could accomplish and just pushing myself.
What kind of preparation is involved when you do something? I'm going to pick on one of my favorites of your stunts. When you do something like taking a goat inside of an Apple store.
Okay, so most of these projects are my curiosity. For a whole year, I was talking to Apple store employees whenever I was in the Apple store, and I would ask them questions. Conceivably, in an Apple store, could you do blank? And I would give them outrageous scenarios, like, could you bring a goat into an Apple store? They would scratch their heads, they would pause for about 10 seconds, and they would say, I don't see why not. No one had ever made a video to document this thing. You could do almost anything in an Apple store. When I set out to do this, I was not completely sure that I would be able to get away with everything I was doing, all these stunts in the Apple store. So I know I wanted to bring a goat into the Apple store, and I asked Apple people, could you bring a goat? And they said, I don't see why not. So I think I put in my Facebook status, I needed a goat, and within an hour or two, I had my pick of a few different goats. Right? Isn't that crazy?
That is insane.
So I found a goat, I think in New Jersey. It was like a woman who does children's birthday parties. So I think it was for a few $100s. I had a goat in the middle of Manhattan, jaded New Yorkers doing double takes and freaking out. If you can get jaded New Yorkers to react, you know you're doing something right.
How did you choose the right goat? How did you decide which one you're going to take into the Apple store?
I trusted the handler. We talked on the phone, and she described my different goat options, and I thought Nala, the goat, was the right goat, and it turned out to be a good choice. And I just had no idea what was happening. I was very, very nervous to bring the goat in the Apple store. My wife, Christine, who works with me on a lot of these projects, was physically nauseous as we were making our way over to the Apple store because she was just afraid we were going to get in lots of trouble. And I said the worst thing they're going to do is they're going to ask us politely to leave. But it turns out that the Apple store was totally cool with it. And I subsequently have had Apple employees anonymously come up to me in public and tell me that they show the video to new trainees at times to show them the crazy stuff that can go on in an Apple store. And I just want to also say that this video, and it got a lot of views, it got over 1 million views, it made Apple look good. I'm never out to make anyone look bad. I thought, if anything, that made them look cool that they would let people do this, and I heard that they were happy with it. So I think it was a win-win.
It certainly does seem to be. You touched on something I'd really wondered about, because in your videos you seem to show absolutely no fear. What's scary? As you laugh hysterically. What's scary for you about this when you start doing a crazy stunt?
It's a lot of just like on paper, some of the stuff seems impossible. Can I really do this? It's just one of those things that what are the things that could go wrong and just can I get through it? Like, I had the idea to get over my genuine fear of flying on an airplane, to live on an airplane for a month where I couldn't get off that would make me face my fear head on. And on paper, you know, it kind of sounds doable, but I was able to make it happen where I did stay on a plane for a month and took 135 flights, which set a Guinness World Record. But that thing was a lot of anxiety going in because I had a genuine fear of flying. And then as I was doing it, I was able to get off over my fear after a week and a half of flying nonstop, talking to the pilots and the flight attendants, who were my unpaid therapists, more or less. But there was lots of anxiety not being able to get off that plane. And, you know, I couldn't shower for a month, and there were all these things. So that was probably the most nerve-wracking thing, and just normally I can work through that anxiety, but it wasn't until I hit the halfway mark that I knew I'd be okay. But that was an example of something that the anxiety just, it really was there for most of the project.
Having done that, do you feel any fear of anything you're going to do in the future?
Not too much. I mean, I still get really excited, and I get anxiety, but it's more an exciting anxiety. Can I make this happen? But not too much fear. I mean, the stuff that I try to pick these days, the stuff's challenging, but it's not like the overwhelming thing of living on an airplane. I try to pick fun things once in a while. Like I did this project in Los Angeles where I didn't want to spend thousands on a hotel, so I wanted to see if I could convince famous people to let me sleep over at their homes. And I did a web series called Celebrity Sleepover where I asked people I did not know. I mean, 95% of the people, I knew who they were, but I didn't know them. So I wrote letters, sent them in the mail. I used Facebook and other means to try to get a hold of them. And I said, can I sleep over at your place? And I was able to convince something like 13 people to say yes. And that was just pure fun. That was the first project, maybe since IKEA, that was just pure fun. And I like doing those. But that was, again, can I pull this off, like to convince famous people to let a dude that they don't know sleep over?
What was the absolute most fun moment from your celebrity sleepovers?
Oh my goodness. Maybe slow dancing with Justine Bateman from Family Ties, just because I had a crush on her as a kid. And we had Lisa Loeb, who's a really talented musician, write this song about my crush on Justine Bateman. It's called Middle School Mark. I had a crush when I was in middle school. So I think slow dancing with Justine at her place, that was kind of fun. I enjoyed it. I mean, there were so many good times in that series. I mean, it was just, I did not want it to end. I mean, sometimes I do these projects and I just get in this world, like when I lived in IKEA, where I'm just, it's this place that doesn't exist. It's like not real reality, but I want it to be reality. And it's just, after a while, I have to go back to my life in New York City and Queens with my cats and my wife, which is good, and I'm very happy to be here. But sometimes that escape, it becomes magical, and I don't want it to end sometimes.
You're creating a lot of magic here is what I'm seeing. As a filmmaker, what kinds of permissions do you have to get? Because in L.A., if you sneeze, you have to have filmmaking permission practically.
Yeah, it's a little bit more lax here. I mean, I normally do get releases, but, I only want to film with people that want to be in stuff. So I don't, for the most part, ever, I mean, at least since I've been doing this professionally, I don't go up to people guerrilla style unless they want to be on camera. So I'm not out to make anyone look bad. I basically state my case, and if they're cool to be filmed, we do it. But normally if I'm filming on the street, it's just one or two people, so we can kind of do our thing. And I certainly have filmed in L.A. in people's homes, which is a lot easier than, of course, getting on the street and permits and stuff. So I've had a relatively easy time so far with that.
That was interesting, especially watching you on the New York City bus, because I was thinking, wow, in L.A., there's no way you'd have to have about six different kinds of permission.
I never even thought of that. Yeah, I think in New York, anything on with the MTA, I guess anything kind of goes. Yeah, I did that race. It was a race. I rode a child's big wheel, which is like a mini tricycle against the New York City bus. I raced it 1 mile on 42nd Street in the middle of traffic. It was 1 mile from 10th Avenue to Madison on 42nd Street, and I ended up winning by 2 minutes. So the big child's big wheel beat the bus. So I think that's probably what you were referring to, I'm guessing. And that was a lot of training, and that took me about a month of research to figure out. But it was very cathartic, and I think a lot of New Yorkers, I heard from them that they were cheering me on, because we can all, I think anyone that lives in New York can relate to how frustrating it is that the buses go so slow.
I grew up in New York City, and I was relating to that myself, watching you pedal through traffic. Like, there's no way he's not going to beat this bus. It was great.
Oh, yeah, it was definitely, my feet were in massive pain because of the short pedals on the bus, and there was a 20% chance the bus would have beat me. I did all these times to record, so definitely adrenaline took over, because I didn't want to have to lose and do the race again, so just the adrenaline overpowered me, and I won. Yay, take that MTA.
Yay. What would you really like people to learn from what you do as a filmmaker and comedian? What can they take away from your experience about creativity?
That's a really good question. I think a few things. One, I think, is follow passion, follow curiosity. Do not be afraid to knock on doors and ask. The power of asking cannot be underestimated. And I just think whatever decision people make is if they want to do films or if they want to do videos or if they want to do anything, it should be stuff that comes out of their heart, out of love, and they shouldn't be doing it for any other reason that they're in love with the work and they just want to create something for them. And it happens to get a lot of attention, and it happens to, you know, explode in terms of, you know, doing well with industry or with fans. That is a bonus, but I think that's almost a result. But the number one thing should be creating something that they're in love with, that comes out of their heart. So those are some things that I think.
Do we have one more minute? I'd love to promote your Two Juice Minimum and your podcast.
Oh, gosh, that's nice. Yeah, let's talk about them. The Johnny Carson-themed podcast is going to be every Wednesday. We have some big names coming up. I was obsessed with Johnny Carson and the Tonight Show when I was a kid. He went off the air when I was a teenager, but I just had really fun moments from it, and I just wanted to talk to people that their lives were changed by going on Carson, people that regularly appeared on the show, as well as people that worked for him. So I've gotten to talk to a lot of really interesting big names for this.
For example, let's talk for a moment about Byron Allen. What was the story that he told you?
Oh, gosh. So Byron Allen, who is a comedian, a host, entrepreneur, he's going to be coming on an episode that by this time will already be on. I didn't know this. I knew he made his debut when he was 18 doing stand-up on Carson, which was really young. I mean, most people were in their, mid to late 20s, even their 30s. He did it at 18. The thing that was fascinating is his mom got a job when he was a teenager at NBC Burbank, so he would hang out in the halls and got to know Johnny Carson when he was, 13, 14 years old. He used to go up to Sanford and Son and hang out with Red Fox. He'd go over, hang out with Freddie Prinze at Chico and the Man, and all these people got to know him when he was a teenager. When Johnny Carson's taping was over at 6:30, Byron Allen would sit at the desk as a teenager and interview janitors and maids at NBC and do his own version of The Tonight Show just with no audience. And it was this story that just really struck me that this needs to be a movie about this kid who moves from Detroit when he's a teenager, and it's fish out of water that he just discovers this world. He would go, when Bill Cosby, for example, would be a guest on Carson, he would go backstage and Cosby would greet him, Byron! And I have a friend, actually, who was there at the time who verified for everything Byron Allen says and more. It's just a really special story, and it culminates with Byron Allen, making his debut when he's 18 on Carson. They asked him when he was 17 to do stand-up, and he said, I don't think I'm ready yet. I want to be graduated from high school. So a week after he graduated high school, he goes on Carson, and he told me he knew his life would never be the same, and it hasn't. And he was writing for Jimmy J.J. Walker when he was a teenager, so it was David Letterman, Jay Leno, and him. And, Leno and Letterman, I think, were in their 30s, late 20s, and Byron Allen, again, was 14, 15, so it's just this story that just really touched me, and I think it's going to touch a lot of listeners. So that was a great episode. We have Mel Brooks is coming up, Carl Reiner, a lot of fun guests on the Carson podcast. It's been a blast, and it's been thrilling to sit down with these people and hear the stories.
Available on iTunes. People are going to have to check that out. And by the way, I'm struck by the wisdom that he had at 17. How many 17-year-olds would say, no, I have to finish high school first?
Yeah, I know. I couldn't believe it. I had no idea that he turned it down. I've never heard anybody say no like that to the show. It was definitely he played his cards right, for sure.
He did. How also did your Two Juice Minimum come about, your kids' show?
Yeah, the Two Juice Minimum show was that, I teach Sunday school to kids, and for some reason, I've always just been really good with kids. When I was 22, when I graduated NYU, just for a day job here and there, I was a babysitter, and all the kids would ask their parents on the playground, can Mark be our babysitter? And I did not want to become the male babysitter. I didn't want that to be my career, so I got out of it. But, once in a while, if I was available and stuff, I would babysit and stuff. And for some reason, the kids were always just, always really liked my comedy. I would always just kind of be silly and stuff, and they always took to me. So I decided I would just do a kid's show because everybody told me, Mark, you need to do a kid's show. So it just took a while, and I do this show here in New York on Sundays at 3 o'clock. We've had Rachel Dratch from Saturday Night Live and Grizz Chapman from 30 Rock. We have, I think, Morgan Spurlock is coming up on the show, Andrew W.K. So we get these guests, and, the kids go crazy for the show. We have sketches. We have videos. I host the show. I think we're going to have a 14-year-old stand-up who approached me through his mom that wanted to come on the show. So, yeah, we're still, experimenting with the show and the voice, but it could not have been, it's been going so well, could not be going better. So that's just been a treat. I want to definitely keep doing the show.
What's one of the best lessons you've learned from your young audiences about being an artist and being creative?
Kids will always tell the truth. They're adults, not always. But if kids find something funny, they will laugh. If there's not something funny, they will not laugh. Whereas adults, are polite. Kids are just always truthful. So you know, if something works, I know it right away. If not, you know, we tweak the show. But just the enthusiasm that the kids have is just such a good lesson, just that for grown-ups, sometimes people just lose their padness when they come out and do this show, and the enthusiasm is just such a good thing that I always take away from doing this show and just try to keep that, you know, that spirit of a kid that just, you know, happy and just wide-eyed. I think that's a good thing for adults to have.
Mark, thank you for your time today.
Oh, it was a pleasure. This was so much fun. I appreciate you asking.
You and I have been listening to filmmaker and comedian Mark Malkoff. You can check out Mark's videos and the Carson Show podcast on his website, markmalkoff.com. That's Mark Malkoff, Malkoff.com. It seems only fair to warn you that his videos and his podcast are highly addictive. My favorite video so far is his Apple Store challenge, which is laugh out loud funny no matter how many times you've seen it. Also, if you happen to be in the New York area and would like to see Mark perform live, his kids' comedy show, Two Juice Minimum, happens Sunday afternoons in New York City. On his website, markmalkoff.com, if you'll click on the link to his Facebook page, you'll find more information about where he's performing and the times. And that concludes this edition of Over Coffee. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear more Over Coffee podcasts, our link is twomaverix.com. That's twomaverix.com. And you can contact us at twomaverix@gmail.com. The music you're hearing is royalty-free production music provided by Pond5 at pond5.com. I'm Dot Cannon. Here's wishing you a cappuccino day.